I understand perfectly well the logic of what you're saying. Whether that's a saleable amendment is a very different question. And the problem becomes, if there are 650 or 700 news outlets, how are they supposed to know with whom, to whom they're supposed to give this money? If people don't come forward and put their hands up and bargain, they can't, you know, you, I mean...
That's why you built the QCJO system for all of its problems.
Yeah.
It at least is like a decent effort to figure out who's in and who's out. That part's solved. Who's in is QCJO, and now C18 has this other thing that the CRTC has a few different pretty wide open definitions of who gets considered a news company. So that part, I'm not asking for any changes to that. But if you're in, like, here's what happened in Australia. They hail it as a great success because 24 small digital publishers collectively bargained and they got money from Google, not Facebook. They got cut out from Facebook, but they got some good money from Google. I was recently at a symposium where I asked some people involved, what happens to the 25th digital publisher? They've got to wait for another couple dozen, team up with them, hire lawyers, and go back and bargain again.
Yeah. And it's really important to understand in Australia, too, is that they never actually pulled the trigger on the bill.
Yeah.
There is not a single company in Australia that is covered by the legislation. All the legislation did was force Google and Facebook to make side deals with everybody.
This isn't a bill, it's a threat, right? It's a do a bunch of stuff or else we're going to regulate you.
Yeah.
And I think that's because government doesn't want to get its hands dirty, because news is dirty. Determining who's news and who isn't news.
And then there's this whole other thing that we haven't talked about yet, which is that the bill now says that anybody who is in has to have a code of ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the people in the broadcasters say to me, the Canadian Association of Broadcasters said, well, you know, we're already regulated by the Broadcast Standards Council. It's like, yes, that's true. That's because public spectrum is a public good. And the government has always regulated broadcasters. No one has ever regulated print. And I'm really uncomfortable with the idea of the government saying, you print publication, or I mean, print or digital publication, I guess we should say, don't get any money unless you have a code of conduct that we sign off on.
It makes me gag if you care about an independent press. But you know what? It made me gag a year ago, but now it's done. Like, fine.
And who's to say, well, you know, anybody can have a code of conduct. You know, you can make a code of conduct that says, you know, the code of conduct is that, you know, every week Jesse Brown must be delivered, you know, three cappuccinos.
Who told
and
you?
And some of those, like, yeah, some of those really good Portuguese Nutella tarts, you know?
Somebody has obviously leaked our code of conduct to the senator.
But you know, I mean, what if the code of conduct isn't to your taste? And hey, wait a minute. What if Justin Trudeau isn't prime minister? What if somebody else is prime minister? Now, do you want that government deciding what's disinformation? I'm from Alberta, where, you know, the Alberta government at a certain point decided that anybody who talked about the environmental ramifications of the oil and gas industry, that was disinformation. I mean, do you really want governments deciding what's legitimate news and what isn't? No.
No, but it's done. I worried about this a year ago, and I worried about, you know, so in order to determine who gets to be called a qualified Canadian journalism organization, the government says, well, the government's not picking the winners and losers because we've set up this independent board. Well, actually, the Heritage Minister has final say on it, but don't worry, we're not going to use that final say. But, you know, anything that can be done might eventually be done. And these theoretical concerns, as a legislator, I know you have to worry about how this might be abused and used. But as a business person, I have to worry about what's happening today. And the role of legislation and the threat of legislation has had these impacts already. So we're asking for fairness that, okay, even if we're going to do it under this auspice of like, go come to an agreement, let the terms of that agreement be standardized, which also gives the transparency and removes the influence question, which it sounds like you're like, hey, that's going to be complicated. So I don't know how we're doing there.
Send us the text of the amendment.
We got it. I'm doing all the kinds of grown-up things. We hired a lobbyist to help us write these things.
Woo, very exciting.
Here's the other one.
What's the other one? What else does Jesse want?
Jesse and the other digital publishing consortium people, and I hate that this has all made me play nicely with others. I'm supposed to be scrutinizing all these other media companies, not forming cartels with them. But there's a huge loophole in this whole act, that this exemption order thing, that if Google and Facebook satisfy the bill under some amorphous, undefined, punted over to regulations or to CRTC, if they do that, then the bill doesn't apply to them.
That's right.
And we're all very concerned that they're going to say, okay, we've got the big guys. We've got the Globe. We've got the Post Media. CBC's in here. A handful of little guys. So we're exempt, right? And then they get an exemption order. And what does that mean for the future of media and every company that has yet to be? Because, like, really, the future of media, we've almost, like, without a debate, come to a faulty consensus that the future of media means prolonging all of our old media. Whereas I would say that if we're going to have a vibrant and vital, aggressive news media in Canada that holds power to account, that's going to be, like, 1,000 companies that don't even have names yet. And they're all basically cut out of this thing.
Yeah. And again, we're presupposing that Google and Facebook are going to cough up the money. Because if Google says, well, you're predicating this on the argument that we're stealing the content, so tell you what, we won't steal the content anymore. We're good now, right?
Isn't that hilarious? They're totally going to do that, you know? They're already doing it.
So, you know, if the government had constructed a bill on a different paradigm, on a paradigm of corporate concentration in the advertising market, Google commands 90% of search globally. 90%.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's extraordinary. That's not free market capitalism. That's a functional monopoly. You know, imagine that Microsoft is the tiny little player in this. I mean, poor little Bing, which has, what, 2%, 3% of the search market in Canada? It is Google. So if a government had said, whether it's the American government or the Canadian government or the Australian government had said, look, the issue isn't that you stole the news. The issue is that there is not healthy competition in the advertising and search markets. And therefore, we want you to, you know.
Say the word antitrust.
Yeah. If you used Combine's legislation, if you had the Competition Bureau deal with this, I think that would have been a much more logical nexus. But because everybody got obsessed with the idea of stealing the news, I mean, the issue is follow the money.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that we have this insane corporate concentration where Google and Facebook together are 80% of the advertising market in Canada. And so all of that advertising money leaves the country and goes to fund these giant corporations who are in no way accountable here.
That's how it should be. They should break them up, but that's not happening. That's not going to happen.
No, they're not Canadian companies. So until such time as an American government wants to be aggressive about, you know, breaking them up the way they broke up the phone company in the States, I mean, is that going to happen in my lifetime? I don't think so. Should I now be praying to Bill Gates to make Bing better so that Bing is a competitor? I mean, certainly in Australia, when Google threatened to pull out, what I've been told by the Australian people I've spoken with is that Bing was right there, Johnny on the spot, to say, well, it's okay. If Google leaves, we'll be here.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine that if Google says it's not going to index Canadian news, that Bing would be more than happy to fill that void. But how many of us have built our lives around Google products?
It would be pretty weird if Canada is like Bingland. That would be pretty weird.
That's right. You know, I mean, I guess it's possible that Bing would then give us Bing Maps and Bing Directions and Bing Mail, but it would be very peculiar. I mean, how can Google answer people's questions if it stops indexing the news, if it stops sending news links? I mean, it's a bit silly.
Imagine if they actually don't think we're as important as we do. Imagine if they did it and people were okay with it. I mean, I could think of Stranger Things. What a mess. What a mess the government has made of this issue. Like, I've never really been a person who understood when you would hear people say, like, get the government out of my business. You know, like, that always felt like some, you know, angry, weird, like...
Albertan.
Yeah, it felt very Albertan. I self-identified as an Albertan, but maybe, like, I really just feel like... We were doing fine. We were growing every year. I mean, like, we're still doing okay. We're still doing well. But I can't responsibly ignore all of the things that have shifted around me that have made the playing field really uneven. And I've had to get in the game in a way that I'm deeply uncomfortable with to try to have some minor impact on a mess not of my making.
Have you asked to be a witness in the Senate?
I was asked to be a witness, and I told Senator Clement that I'd be glad to. I haven't heard back yet since I was asked some time ago, so I'm not sure where that's at.
You know, we don't always hear from every person who asks, but we do want to hear from people who have something important to add to the conversation. So you can certainly put your name forward, but we don't have witness lists yet because the bill has not yet come to committee. The bill is still in the Senate. We're waiting for the official critic, Senator Fabian Manning, to speak. I think his probably will be the last or one of the last speeches on the bill.
This is how the sausage gets made. I am now hopeful that of the possible people called to be a witness, I will be one, and then I will present our amendments, or maybe one of my colleagues will, from this coalition, and then I'm hopeful that you'll listen to us and actually write an amendment, which based on this conversation, I'm not quite so sure what our odds are. And then I am hopeful that those amendments will be accepted by Pablo Rodriguez, which based on his rejection of the pivotal amendment in C-11, I expect he'll reject it, at which point it'll be sent back to you and you'll say, well, we got some of what we wanted, but not all of it. And then it'll become a law anyhow.
At the end of the day, I mean, would I like to rewrite this bill top to bottom? Oh, you bet I would. I sometimes think back to the election, not the last one, but the one before that, when there were no Liberal MPs from Alberta. And this little campaign started on Twitter, which I had nothing to do with, for me to be appointed to cabinet, specifically as Minister of Heritage. You can tell that the people who did this campaign didn't understand anything because an Albertan would never be Minister of Heritage. That's not a thing. I sort of sat up in bed and thought, wow, in a different part of the metaverse, I'm the Minister of Heritage and my staff are coming to me with this bill. And how horrible would that be? Happily, in this part of the metaverse, I would never be appointed to cabinet and this would not be my problem. But had it been my problem, I'd like to think I would have come up with a different solution. I care as passionately about the future of Canadian news as anybody, and I particularly care about local news. I mean, Canada Land does a really important job, but it does not report on school board meetings in Fredericton or zoning meetings in Burnaby. Nobody reports on those except local news sources.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's nice that Toronto has four newspapers, but many cities are at risk. I mean, major cities are at risk of having none. So we need to make sure that people get news that they actually need in their communities to figure out the future of their local democracies. And I am very unhopeful that this bill will do that.
Senator, thank you so much. That's your Canada Land. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that you send. We're on Twitter at Canada Land. Our website is canadaland.com. Tristan Capicchione is our audio editor and technical producer. Our managing editor is Annette Ejiofor. I am your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Montreal-based Toronto Star reporter and current National Newspaper Award nominee for your reporting for the Star from Russia. Welcome to Shortcuts.
Awfully nice of you to mention that. I'm super excited. It's one of the things that you apply often for, and you know, you never really know how it's going to turn out. So I'm super stoked just to be nominated, as they say.
Today on the show, Donald Trump. We suddenly have to care about him again. Or do we? Do we? I'm Jonathan Goldsby. Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump says he's expecting to be arrested this upcoming Tuesday.
Trump is being investigated by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office in connection to the Stormy Daniels hush money case.
New York officials are taking security arrangements around Manhattan.
If anything, charges will likely energize Trump's base. It's why he's fundraising off the prospect of being arrested.
So we're recording this Wednesday morning at 11, and as of now, and I will just go on Twitter to double check, former U.S. President Donald Trump has not been indicted. By the time listeners hear this, however, he very well may have been. So we're speaking to you, listeners, from the past, a time capsule of the relative innocence and ignorance of Wednesday, March 22nd, 2023, immediately before American politics changed forever, or perhaps not at all. A sort of Schrodinger's cast, if you will, if cast is short for podcast. So for now, we're going to look at what's been going on, what's likely to unfold, and the extent to which Canadians ought to care about it. So, Alan, you wrote an explainer for the Toronto Star titled, What Happens If Donald Trump Gets Arrested? But before we get to the question of what happens, I guess we should address the question of why would he be arrested, or at least what would this arrest be about, and why, after so many years of, I guess, false starts for formal accountability processes, do we believe something is now almost certainly imminent?
It's a good point that it's sort of tough to keep track of all the different legal processes that are underway. Mm-hmm. So this one is not about classified documents. It's not about tax evasion by the Trump Organization. It's not about election fraud. It's about falsification of business records, as far as we know. We don't know exactly what the charges will be, but the best guess from people who have been following this in the States for years and years is that it relates to, as we like to say over and over in the media, hush money paid to a porn star, mm-hmm. this porn star being Stormy Daniels. Before the 2016 election, mm-hmm. she was shopping around her story of an alleged sexual encounter with Donald Trump, and she was paid a certain amount of money, $130,000, by a lawyer who's sort of acted as a fixer for Donald Trump. This was basically to shut her up so that she would not speak to the National Enquirer or any other media, and so that ultimately, according to prosecutors and those who've been investigating this, ultimately so that he would win the election, so that it wouldn't throw off people at the last minute and cause them to vote for Hillary Clinton. The problem is falsification of business records. The larger issue is an attempt to sway the presidential election in 2016. Michael Cohen, who's the bag man, if you will, he was indicted and pled guilty in 2018 for his part in this. Donald Trump was not indicted by federal prosecutors. Mm-hmm. And so now we're dealing with this at a lower level, at the state level in New York. And this is what they've come up with in terms of a charge. It's almost like investigating Al Capone for tax evasion.
Exactly. With this alleged crime having happened over 6 years ago, why do we believe this is about to imminently climax?
Because in New York State, they've been investigating Trump and the Trump Organization very intensively for a number of years. They had one recent ruling against the Trump Organization for tax mm-hmm. fraud or tax evasion. And this is almost the next shoe to fall in that investigation. And so this is, this is what they're going after. There's all sorts of legal questions, right? Mm-hmm. It's, falsifying business records is a very minor offense generally. You get up to a year in jail and up to, $1,000 fine, which is for Donald Trump, who's a billionaire, is chump change or Trump change.
Of course, yeah.
What they may do is try and prove that he falsified business records in order to commit a crime, mm-hmm. which that being federal election interference. And so that would be a felony charge and could land him up to 5 years in jail.
And I guess the reason it's suddenly all of a sudden on the radar, as opposed to, at least four other investigations, I've slowly been bubbling away, because Trump exclaimed on his proprietary social media platform over the weekend that he is going to be arrested on Tuesday, which Tuesday came and went, and that didn't happen. And there are people who would take Trump at his word. I would not listen to them. But most people, I would say at this point, even people who like him, would not necessarily take him at his literal word. But there are other signs that this is imminent.
There's a grand jury investigation underway. Mm-hmm. One of the lawyers, who was brought in to support Trump, he testified on Monday. And he walked out of the grand jury investigation, and then he gave a news conference to the reporters that are assembled there. We know this is going on in real time, right? Literally, as you said, Trump could be charged at any minute. They're having meetings in New York City about how to handle the fallout, the protesters, crowd control, whether to do a perp walk, whether to arrest them in public and walk them through the cameras. And apparently, there's even reports this morning that Trump would like to, should I smile mm-hmm. For the cameras as I'm doing this? Should I say something? And he sees this as a moment in the sun, right?
Exactly. And certainly the authorities in New York, not even just those directly involved in the potential prosecution, but all kinds of authorities in New York are absolutely bracing for something. And I think one could reasonably assume that if there were not something coming, they would have been told that, like, you don't actually have to, like, get everyone out on the street and erect all these barricades and take all these steps. Certainly they're taking the prospect of something happening imminently very, very seriously. And so I guess that next goes to the question posed by the headline, at least the online headline of your story. What happens if he's indicted?
This will be the first an historic moment, right? He will be a former president charged with a crime. Richard Nixon was not charged with a crime. You know, there was an indictment in that case, but they didn't go ahead with it. So he'll be charged. He'll be fingerprinted. He'll be mugshotted. You know, he'll have his day in court like any other alleged criminal. I think the larger question is the political question, right? What happens there? What is the calculation there? And sort of back to the earlier point, from a media perspective, he's the one who's putting us all out there, right? Mm-hmm. He's the one who said on Saturday, yeah, they're going to arrest me on Tuesday, right? And it was like part two of a, you know, two-part diatribe against the, you know, the prosecutor and the alleged persecution that he's been facing. You know, go back to last summer when the FBI raided his Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach. He was the one who announced that. Mm-hmm. You know, no one knew it until he said it on Truth Social. And so he's still in control of the message here, right? It's fascinating. I was thinking about how do you describe this as, you know, as a Canadian? It's almost like looking over the fence at your neighbor's nasty sort of domestic dispute, right? Like looking to see what's going on. It's a bit nuts, but you can't look away.
Beyond this, the question of, as much as the United States is not great at generally at holding powerful people to account through public processes, Canada is even worse at that. But to the more particular point, like in the States, we usually get to see mugshots. And in Canada, we almost never do. Presuming that he is charged, he will be photographed, and that will almost certainly be released immediately. And what I find fascinating is one something that, in most cases, would count against a person. It sounds like he's looking forward to that and has been giving a lot of thought to how he can look the most defiant.
It's insane, but you can almost imagine, like, you know, a presidential campaign or, you know, a fundraiser email with his mugshot on it, right? Like the worry from prosecutors and from Democrats and even from some of his Republican opponents in the primary is this plays into his narrative that he is sort of a sacrificial lamb, that he's being persecuted, that he's taking all these hits and fighting back against it to protect, you know, the true American patriots that are his base, as he claims. Mm-hmm. It defies belief. It makes me think, I mean, a bit of the Rob Ford days, right? Where you almost think, how much lower can you go? And then you keep digging, right? And it goes lower.
I know. And certainly I covered that. And there are many, many times when it seemed like an arrest could be imminent.
And if he's going to arrest me, arrest me. I have done nothing wrong. And he's wasted millions of dollars.
Someone could lean into it even more. And, you know, Shortcuts is supposed to look at the week's biggest news, and barring a global calamity, the arrest and indictment of Donald Trump would probably be the biggest news of any given week in which it takes place, dominating, you know, front pages and leading our newscasts.
And this is a week in which President Biden is visiting Canada too,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So. I guess extra publicity for the scrum at Beaver Tails, I suppose. But, like, unlike a lot of other political, I mean, like American political news, like where the implications for Canada and the larger world are instantly apparent, I guess I find myself trying to interrogate the philosophical underpinning of why this would be the biggest news. Because, I mean, it would be the biggest news and it deserves its place of prominence. I mean, it's historic and unprecedented. As far as I know, no Canadian prime minister or former prime minister has ever been charged with a crime. And yet the immediate relevance that this would have outside the States strikes me as almost elusive. Like, it's easy to imagine having a butterfly effect that eventually leads to his return to the White House and then anything up to and including nuclear Armageddon. But it's also to imagine this being, like, not really of any more consequence than, like, his second impeachment, which was also unprecedented and historic, but ultimately not super meaningful in and of itself. So, like, is this an epilogue, a coda, or just the start of, like, volume two or three?
And this goes back to sort of the Rob Ford comparison, right? It's like, how low will you go? And it's, I mean, you know, a misdemeanor or even a felony offense for, you know, falsifying business records is not the end of Donald Trump. It's highly unlikely he would go to jail for something like this. It's highly unlikely that there would be a conviction before a presidential campaign. I talked to a political science guy, you know, someone who was in the States for a long time and came back to Canada recently, and it doesn't allow him to grow his base, right? So like the hardcore true believers are still going to be hardcore true believers. But those ones who are like, eh, Donald Trump, he's a bit weird. You know, yeah, maybe he's good for the economy, but like he's slimy. They're not going to all of a sudden jump on the bandwagon because he's being persecuted for hush money paid to a porn star.
I think some might.
Do you really?
There's a certain brand of conservative who will instinctively jump to someone they like who they believe is being wrongfully targeted. Like, say, Conrad Black, obviously. Mm-hmm. Like, he actually got off the Trump train last fall. I'd missed this. Like, he boldly predicted that the headline in the Post was actually Trump's revenge. This was like 2 days before the midterms, that Trump would be stronger than ever. Republicans would sweep to midterms. And then when that didn't happen, he's like, actually, maybe we'll regret to say I kind of throw my support behind Ron DeSantis instead.
I'm out.
Yeah, basically, but like weird, in a weirdly tentative way. For him, tentative. And the sentence included the word obloquy, which I had to look up. The thing is, I think someone like Conrad Black, if Trump is indicted, would absolutely fly right back to his camp.
Perhaps.
There's a type of conservative, yeah, that is absolutely animated by perceived injustice against or persecution of people they like or have an affinity for or identify with. In the case of Conrad Black, someone who believes he himself was wrongfully prosecuted. So I don't know. I think that that is a way to grow one's base, or at least reclaim portions of one's base.
In the case of Conrad Black, who, as far as I know, doesn't have the right to vote in the U.S.,
no.
Is that because he sees his own persecution and Donald Trump's persecution? I mean, you know, it's a mirror.
I mean, Black apparently once drew that comparison in a conversation with Trump himself. In 2019, he wrote in the National Post that when Trump phoned him to offer the pardon, "I suggested that he knew better than anyone the antics of some U.S. prosecutors." And you can kind of imagine him chuckling. You've spent much of your career as a foreign reporter explaining news in other countries to Canadians and explaining the relevance. If you were to play this on the front page of a daily newspaper, if you're the front page editor, how would you frame it?
Hey, look, I mean, a certain amount of our coverage of American politics in Canada is voyeuristic, right? You know, we are looking at the, you know, the most powerful country in the world. It still is. You know, but I remember back in my early days as a crime reporter at the National Post, and I did this thing on gangs and gangs and guns and drugs, and I talked to an investigator who said Canada, in terms of crime trends, is a couple of years, maybe you know, up to 10 years behind the U.S. So whatever's happening in the U.S., it's going to come to Canada. It's going to it's eventually going to reach here. Politics is not that different. And if anything, it's speeding up. I mean, you look at, we had the January 6th insurrection on Capitol Hill. A year later, we had the Freedom Convoy, right? In January 6th, they were trying to overturn the election. The Freedom Convoy, there was a segment, and certainly not all, but there was a segment who said, we want Trudeau and his government to resign or to be removed from power. There are thoughts and sentiments and ideologies, you know, they transfer. We consume American media, you know, more than they consume our media, and so, you know, is this a sign of what's to come? I mean, in Canada, are we going to be susceptible to the same sort of political chaos that that they're living through in the United States right now?
I mean, that would probably presume that we ever ended up actually prosecuting politicians at all. You mentioned the National Post, and that reminds me of one more thing, which was that this whole thing with Stormy Daniels allegedly began when she or her counsel went to the National Enquirer back in October 2016, and the person who was in charge of the Enquirer's parent company at the time, Trump's friend David Pecker, allegedly then referred her to Michael Cohen and to the Trump camp to basically purchase the story to hush it up. You know, in that same month, Pecker joined the board of Post Media, Canada's largest newspaper chain.
I didn't know that.
Where he stayed for almost 2 years until late in the summer of 2018, which was just shortly after the FBI subpoenaed his company's records as they were looking for stuff related to...
In the Cohen investigation.
Yes, exactly.
Well, because there was a second woman involved.
Yes, and he was definitely involved in that, the Karen McDougall one. And Pecker was seen, I guess, at the courthouse, I think in late January, by presumably testifying or speaking before the grand jury. Well, that was like, oh yeah, David Pecker.
There you go. That is interesting.
That's Shortcuts for this week. Thanks for joining me, Alan.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm happy to have the chance to talk to you.
We are on Twitter at CanadaLand. You can email me at jonathan@canadaland.com. I will, at the very least, read everything you send. People can also find me on Twitter at Goldsby. Where can people find you, Alan?
I'm on Twitter at Woods Allen. And I'm in the Toronto Star.
This episode is produced by Aviva Lessard with additional production by Tristan Capicchione. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofo. Theme music is by So-Called Syndications by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.